This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
A small business attempts to bring back a dying technology. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 30th, Memorial Day. Thanks so much for being with us. We got news from the Commerce Department last week that sales of new homes were at an 8-year high in April. Home prices have also been climbing around the country. Tomorrow, we'll add another data point when the Case-Shiller home price numbers come out. But as with so many things in economics, high prices all depend on how you look at them. According to an index that tracks what's called real house prices, the cost of buying a home is still almost 40% below its 2006 peak. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace explains.
Say I told you that houses in San Francisco today are not much more expensive than they were 10 years ago. Would you buy that? Mark Fleming is chief economist with First American Financial Corporation, the mortgage servicing and insurance company that puts out this real home price index. He says, yes, list prices might be going up, but
that doesn't take into account the fact that buying power has increased so dramatically because interest rates have come down over the years.
His measure looks at price alongside median income and interest rates to argue buying a home is relatively affordable right now. Susan Wachter, a professor of real estate at the Wharton School at Penn, says she sees the logic. If you look at those low interest rates, you might think,
wow, what a good time to be a homeowner, which is just what this index says.
And Wachter says some first-time homebuyers might hypothetically be able to afford it.
But they simply cannot get a mortgage.
Because they don't have, say, $10,000 on hand for a down payment, or because they don't have good credit. David Blitzer is with Standard & Poor's, which puts out a more traditional home price index. In February, that was up about 5% over last year.
That pattern is certainly likely to continue in the near term.
So, low but rising prices, historically low interest rates for now. What's it all add up to for the potential home buyer? Mark Fleming says,
buy now.
But full disclosure,
now that's self-serving. I'm part of the mortgage industry. We want to generate mortgages, right?
Right. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Today, we pay our respects to those who died serving our country. A new study commissioned by the nonprofit organization Blue Star Families says military duty more broadly can take an economic toll, especially on military spouses. From Washington, D.C., Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Military spouses often have to take jobs below their skill level due to frequent moves. Joyce Razor is with the National Military Families Association, which was founded by military wives.
What makes matters worse is if a spouse moves to a new location and has to take a new test or take a class in order to get relicensed in a new state.
She says, like most families, military families need two incomes to get by. But military spouses are about 1.5 times more likely to be unemployed than other civilians. Blue Star Families worked with the Sorensen Impact Center to look at how that affects the broader economy. The center's Jeremy Keel says the cost could be up to about $1 billion, mostly in lost tax revenue.
But there are other costs associated with these disproportionately high rates of unemployment and underemployment in this population, including cost to the government of providing unemployment and welfare benefits to the population.
Meredith Claycamp is director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland, College Park. She says military families can be a bit buffered from the shocks of the broader economy, but they are vulnerable to other issues civilians may not feel, like military sequesters or drawdowns.
As we're winding down from war, we're also downsizing our military. That's leaving some of the military service members wondering if they're going to have their job cut if they are still going to have, you know, the 10 more years that they were planning to put into retirement, or if they're going to be let go.
She says for military families, that's creating the kind of economic uncertainty the recession created for the rest of us. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street was quiet today. The markets are closed for the holiday. But in the rest of the world, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last week, I walked into a small workshop in Pasadena, California, which is home of AEA, Audio Engineering Associates. I was there to meet a guy named Wes Dooley, whose name's probably not going to be familiar to most people. But to a certain pocket of music industry insiders and audio engineers, even here at Marketplace, Dooley is a bit of a star. His company makes what's called a ribbon microphone.
Ribbon mics had their day in the 30s and into the 40s and 50s. You could make sound come out in electrical form if you did this ribbon suspended very loosely in a strong magnetic field. And it dances to the music. And this stuff in the early 30s was really right on the front edge of everything. We could have radio, we could have fireside chats, we could have this sense of intimacy.
Ribbon microphones have a warm sound, almost vintage in their quality. Wes Dooley didn't grow up dreaming of making microphones. Like a lot of us, when he was young, he had no idea what he wanted to do.
My dad was an insurance salesman and said, "Here, I'll show you how you can make more money joining me, you know, Bill Dooley and Son." And I said, "I want to make stuff. I want to make real stuff." And he went, "Well, good luck, kid, but you got to sell it."
Dooley loved music. So to make ends meet, he started working in some Los Angeles music clubs, the Troubadour, the Ice House, and the Ash Grove. A friend showed him how to record music, and he started recording sets. That's when he fell in love with a specific microphone.
That mic could do everything.
That's the RCA.
That's the RCA 44.
And that's a ribbon mic.
That's the ribbon mic.
The 44 ribbon microphone was one of those massive broadcast microphones used by people like Orson Welles and Elvis. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. They were the industry standard, but condenser microphones took over in the 60s and 70s.
Condenser mics are actually way cheaper to make, is not very sensitive to vibration, and can be very small. You can wear them.
RCA stopped making the 44 in 1976. That's when Wes Dooley focused his business on repairing and restoring the mics. Then something else happened. Recordings went digital.
With digital, ribbons started coming back. When you started with something that sounded pleasant and natural to start with, and then the 10th generation copy sounded exactly like the first one, people started going, "Oh, I see why ribbons might be a good idea." Even if they are bulkier and not as stage friendly.
And Dooley decided to take a leap.
We already made parts for our service work for the 20 years we've been doing that, but we didn't make 100%. In 98, after 3 years of effort, I finally made all the parts. I did what I had told myself I would do, preserve the 44, put it back into production.
It wasn't easy. Dooley worked with designers and engineers to perfect his design. He went through several iterations, but finally he had it. His own 44, now with the AEA logo. What was it like when you created that first microphone yourself? What was that moment like when you held it in your hand or heard it for the first time?
The only thing it compares to is my two children.
AEA didn't just recreate the vintage microphones. They modernized them.
We've been honored that we've been able to take it a little bit farther because newer technology.
And what did RCA say when you decided to do that?
RCA has never, ever had an official conversation with us. The patents are all long gone. This is old technology. It's mostly, can you do it? You know, no one's going to get after you if you can duplicate a Stradivarius.
Good luck.
Yeah, but a whole bunch of people have tried.
And AEA's microphones have taken off.
So long.
The Leon Bridges track, So Long, was recorded on AEA ribbon mics. The electric guitars on Wilco's latest album were also recorded on AEA ribbons. And the list goes on, from Emmylou Harris to Pete Townsend.
I was told by Eddie Van Halen that the only mic that sounds like what your ears hear is your 44.
AEA's microphones have been used by composers John Williams and John Kurlander to score movies. Persistence paid off for Wes Dooley. He says he's just glad he chased his dream.
I had decided that, you know, if I lived for a few more years, it would be really fun to leave a legacy so my children, if they ever had children, could point and say, you know, your grandfather did that. And it turned out that I was incredibly lucky, just like with my wife marrying me or having kids. Are you guys being here today?
Wes Dooley, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's a great pleasure, and good night to you all.
The country's gross domestic product grew at 0.8% during the first 3 months of the year, an upward revision of the Commerce Department's initial and more paltry 0.5% estimate. Today, though, we thought we'd take a step back and ask if we pay too much attention to the GDP. It's a calculation that got its start back with the Great Depression and is meant to measure a country's overall economic welfare. Dirk Philipson is a professor at Duke University. He's also the author of The Little Big Number, How GDP Came to Rule the World and What to Do About It. Dirk, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the history of the GDP. Can you talk me through this number and sort of how it came about?
So GDP is an enormously important number, much more important than most people realize. And it came about as a response to the Great Depression because people didn't know what was going on. But important to realize is that it is not an objective number of the economy. It is just a number that very subjectively looks at mere output and mere activities in the market. And so I would argue today it is an irrational obsession that is driving us off the cliff.
Why do you call it an irrational obsession?
Because according to that logic, the more we turn life into commodities, trees into two-by-fours, fossils into fuels, atmosphere into carbon dumps, lakes into resorts, and so on, the better. Why is that a problem? Because in this regime, things like oil spills, accidents, or addictions are the most favorable events because they add money to the economy because they require a lot of goods and services.
Would shifting the lens actually change the way you and I live?
It's not a lens. It's how we measure things. So let me give you just one brief example. If you were to what economists call internalize the externalities of burning fossil fuels, like a gallon of gasoline, if the price of that gallon of gasoline were to include all the external costs, such as pollution and health implications and so on and so forth, it would probably be something like $16 a gallon. Now, this is just one of literally millions of examples, but you can see that if a gallon of gasoline were $16, i.e. reflecting the true cost of burning that gallon of gasoline, where you live, what you drive, whether we support public transportation or roads, whether we live in the city or in suburbs, all of that would immediately change.
Why is the GDP the number we're so fixated on?
Well, in part, it is because it is the one indicator of prosperity of the official economy as it currently is constructed. So it is important because if that number goes down, what we, of course, usually see then is unemployment going up, investments going down, and a lot of bad things happening. So in fact, because it is the definition of the economy, what I'm arguing is that the definition of what we mean by the official economy would also have to change.
But we do need some sense of how our economy is doing, right? So what are the alternatives?
We need to essentially have metrics that reflect what people want. And they need to reflect an economy that serves the benefit of people and not turn it upside down as it is currently, where people and nature are serving the economy.
Dirk Philipson is author of The Little Big Number, How GDP Came to Rule the World and What to Do About It. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up?
It's like a dog chasing itself. It don't matter what you do, you ain't going to catch it.
20 years after welfare reform. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed for Memorial Day. British markets are closed for the spring bank holiday. Germany's DAX gained more than 0.4%. In Asia, the Nikkei boosted more than 1.3%. We're now entering peak hot dog season, the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day, according to the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council. It says Americans typically consume 7 billion hot dogs in that time. The top hot dog eating city last year? Not New York or Chicago, but Los Angeles. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to Marketplace. We got a new podcast called The Uncertain Hour, and the first season looks at the 20 years since the country revamped the welfare system. Back when the reform was being rolled out, Marketplace followed one of the women receiving welfare, Josephine Moore, or Jo, and whether she, as she put it, would sink or swim. Two decades ago, pretty much any woman with a child could get a bit of cash if her income was low enough. The new law sent scores of women into the workforce and set up limitations on how long they could get help. So 20 years later, we wondered, what happened to Jo? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark went to find out.
Hello. Hi. Is this Jo's house? Hi. Hello.
And so to find out, we tracked Jo down, actually up, a very steep, muddy driveway. That's why I'm panting. To a trailer surrounded by an enormous pile of aluminum cans. We wanted to check back in with her.
Come on in. Don't take your boots off.
So nice to meet you.
You too, honey.
Today, Jo's living in that same West Virginia town, Kermit. Jo's 59. She's got steel gray hair in a buzz cut, wireframe glasses. She lives on a piece of mountain her family has owned for generations. Her two-bedroom trailer is decorated with trinkets of ships and wizards, and there are lots of mattresses stashed here and there.
I've got five. Because you never know when somebody's going to show up.
When I visited this winter, Jo's oldest daughter, Estella, was living there. And her son, Johnny, her daughter, Carolina, and a bunch of her grandkids had come to visit for a while.
That's my granddaughter, Tiffany. Wave. And then that's little Latham. And that's my Amber. My kids has always been real good about showing up and bringing me cakes and cookies that I ain't supposed to have.
How had her family fared after welfare reform? Did they sink or did they swim? The short answer, if you looked at Jo's life like a welfare policy researcher might, as a set of data points, moments on welfare and moments off, it'd look like this. Before welfare reform, she had lots of moments on welfare. When her husband lost his job at the coal mine, he had a drinking problem, and she was raising small kids.
I had to go on welfare because I had to feed Johnny and Estella.
When her husband went to prison and she couldn't find enough work cleaning houses.
I had a few jobs here and there, and then I got back on welfare.
But then, soon after the welfare reforms of 1996, once all the work requirements and personal responsibility contracts and time limits set in.
After that, I wasn't on it. I never went back to welfare.
And that has indeed been one of the big findings of poverty researchers and policymakers. Since welfare reform, the welfare rolls have dropped by a lot. And a lot of single mothers, including Jo, found jobs. David Elwood, one of President Clinton's advisors during welfare reform, said these results exceeded even his expectations.
People started working more. Huge increase in the number of lone parents working. Wow, that's really amazing. The program really is working.
Many, many mothers left welfare.
That's Ron Haskins, a congressional staffer on the Republican side during welfare reform. He says in the years right after the bill was passed, this was the bipartisan conclusion. Studies followed single moms in the wake of welfare reform and found that,
roughly speaking, about 60% of the mothers who left welfare got jobs, and they appeared to be better off.
But in the time I spent with Joe and her family at her home in West Virginia, they explained to me it's a little more complicated than that. First off, Joe had worked on and off before welfare reform. Between raising her kids and going to school, she has an associate's degree in secretarial science, she'd do odd jobs, clean houses, take care of elderly people.
Sometimes I'd have enough work where I didn't need the welfare. And if I didn't need it, I didn't want it because that's just for when you need it.
But after welfare reform, even if there were no jobs you could get, you still had to be involved in some sort of work activity for 20 hours a week to qualify for cash assistance.
They would give us a list of places we could go. It was just one more thing we had to do.
She volunteered as a janitor at a local school, helping fold clothes at a Christian charity. This was all a little frustrating to Joe because it meant she didn't have much time to look for work that actually paid.
If the daytime hours is stuck up with you doing the volunteer stuff, when are you going to go find jobs, though?
About a year after welfare reform kicked in, Joe did get a full-time paying job. Not through any government-sponsored welfare-to-work program, but because her sister got sick. Cancer. Joe moved her family down to North Carolina, where her sister lived, to take care of her for a while. The economy was doing much better in North Carolina, and so she found a job at a Tyson chicken factory, cleaning a chicken wings assembly line. She loved it.
I was on maintenance. I cleaned the lines, helped make the chemicals.
Joe's daughter, Carolina, had just graduated high school, and she got a job at the chicken factory, too. And Joe's son, Ransom, got a job there, too. It was hard work that could be dangerous. Carolina lost a thumb on the assembly line in an accident. But Carolina told me just that feeling of supporting herself on a paycheck, not a welfare check. It was worth the thumb.
It was worth it because you was working and you was earning your money. And it felt good to get in that paycheck and being able to cash it and going out and spending your money and knowing you had it.
I've done that a lot. That's true.
You had it and it was yours. It felt good.
And this was all part of the idea behind welfare reform. To use, in the language of public policy, carrots and sticks to get welfare recipients into jobs. The carrots of earning your own paycheck and the satisfaction in that, and the sticks of time limits and work requirements. And I wondered if this had made a difference for Joe and her family.
When welfare changed, when welfare reform changed, do you think it pushed you to get a job sooner than you would have if it had been the same where you didn't need to be working?
No, I don't think so, because I had always been looking for work and trying to get out of it, to be honest.
To Joe's mind, it wasn't about the work requirements or the work ethics that welfare reform was designed to encourage. She says she already wanted to work. As she sees it, there were three main reasons why she never got back on welfare after welfare reform, and they didn't have much to do with welfare reform itself. First, she moved to North Carolina, where the economy was better and jobs were easier to find, and that gave her family enough money that, for the first time, they could afford a car, which is reason number two, Joe thinks she stayed off welfare. When they moved back to West Virginia a few years later, she could actually get to the parts of the state where there were jobs. From where Joe lives in Kermit, the closest town with more than just a few businesses is about a 30-minute drive. There's no public transit.
And without a car, that's 8 hours walking.
8 hours?
Yes. And I know this because I've done it.
You would walk 8 hours?
Yes.
In West Virginia and a lot of rural places with bad economies, that's the double bind that someone like Joe is in. Need a car to get a job.
Because one of the first things they ask is, do you have reliable transportation? And you have to say, no. Well, how are you going to get here? And if you say, well, I'll walk if I have to, they look at you like, yeah, I bet.
But you can't get a car because you don't have enough money because you can't get a job.
It's like a dog chasing itself. It don't matter what you do, you ain't going to catch it.
Once Joe and her family finally did get a car in the late 90s, Joe and her daughters did catch that dog by the tail. They held down a series of jobs, mostly customer service call centers for credit cards, Sprint, Boost Mobile. They were usually at least a 2-hour commute away, but they were jobs. And Joe never did go back on cash welfare. Neither did any of her kids. Not because they haven't hit hard times since then. Few of their jobs have been above minimum wage, meaning they're still often hovering around the poverty line. Jo and her daughters have found other ways of making ends meet when jobs don't pay enough. Like, remember those aluminum cans scattered across the yard in front of Jo's house? She and her kids have been collecting them for the last 2 years.
Springtime, them's going to be loaded up, and that'd probably be enough money to pay the bills a couple of months. I'm thinking there's probably $600-$700 worth of cans out there.
Jo used to collect the cans in big garbage containers, but...
somebody come up here and stole my container.
So now to make the cans harder to steal, she just keeps them scattered across her yard.
Those cans aren't the only way Jo's family makes money. You can hear the rest of the story on our podcast, The Uncertain Hour. This final note before we go today, spotted in the New York Times, a Dutch company is training eagles and other birds of prey to attack and bring down drones. Law enforcement officials say drones could pose threats to public safety, spying, endangering aircraft. One advantage of the birds, they can carry the drones to the ground without crashing them. And also, birds are pretty great.
Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please donate today at marketplace.org.
That's it. That's our show for the day. Markets were closed. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrian Hill. Kai's going to be back tomorrow. Have a safe and happy Memorial Day. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.